Two local bird experts answer your questions about what you're seeing at the feeder, in your shrubs, in the woods, and on the water this spring. This time of year is a bonanza for bird watchers. Millions of birds are passing through Maine on their way to Canada, or arriving to stay for the summer, from exotic places in South and Central America, and from southern states. Many are familiar visitors. Their arrival signals the start of the season. But others may be new to your backyard. Birdwatchers in Maine are already reporting rare sightings, including the spectacular male vermilion flycatcher. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, two birding experts join us to answer your questions, not only about the specific birds you may have spotted this year, but also your questions about changes in Maine's bird population. Maine Calling takes flight next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. At long last, we have some sunny and warm weather, so it's an ideal time to get outside and go bird watching. Most of us can identify a robin or cardinal or woodpecker, but our backyards and woods are filled with so many others. Today, we're going to learn what to look for. With me in the studio, Jan Pearson, who is the owner and founder of Field Guides Birding Tours, and Jeff Wells, who is a research associate at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology and a former bird conservation director for National Audubon. His current project is the Boreal Forest Initiative. I don't have it in my script. The
Boreal Songbird Initiative.
Boreal yes. Songbird Initiative, and the author of Maine's Favorite Birds. We want to hear from you. What kind of questions do you have for our experts? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. About a year ago, Jan, you were sitting here in the studio with me. I'd gone out to meet you and Peter Vickery for a wonderful morning in Portland's Which park were we in?
We were in Evergreen
Cemetery. Evergreen Cemetery, yeah. That's right. Looking for owlets.
Oh, that's right. There were some great horned.
Great horned owlets. And we were with Peter Vickery, who we've since lost. And
we were.
And I know that he was somebody very well known and well loved in the birding community. And I was wondering if you wanted to begin the program by saying a little something about him.
Yes. Well, Peter was all about birds, and he just loved birds. And I know he really enjoyed being on the show last year. He passed away earlier this year after a struggle with cancer for about a year and a half. And I miss him dearly. We used to go out a lot. I was at Evergreen Cemetery again yesterday morning. And on the way down, I thought about Peter. He would have loved that as well. He spent several decades, you know, birding all around Maine and contributing a lot to Maine. And actually, one thing that is continuing that will help carry Peter's memory forward is that he had been working on a book about Maine birds for a number of years. When he got sick, when he was diagnosed, he assembled a team of folks to work with him, and they are carrying on his work to hope. In hopes of wrapping that up.
Well, I remember not,
including Jeff here next to us.
I remember his enthusiasm of entering birds that he was seeing at Evergreen Cemetery almost instantaneously into the database.
That's right, into eBird.
Yep. Into eBird database. Yep. He wasn't, you know, wasting any time. He was making sure everybody knew what he saw that morning.
No, and he had many, many, many records that have been entered into eBird that go back in at least to the 70s, so far as I know. So He was all about birds, and it was great to travel with him anywhere, drive around anywhere in the state, because the enthusiasm was just contagious. So,
and he was kind of the dean of Maine birds almost for the last, I don't know how many decades it's been, and had such a huge impact on so many people. He was kind of my mentor, as a teenager. I used to call him up, and he was patient, would patiently listen to me asking bird questions and tell me what was there and that. And
that's right.
Just fostered that in so many people across Maine and actually across the U.S. and in other parts of the world, too.
And he was amazing. I might say one more thing, which was that my wife, Liz, and I, we wrote a little site guide to the coast of Maine back in 81 and for birders. And we started on a project to cover the whole state in the early 90s. And we were a good ways along, and Peter just showed up at our door one day carrying this big box of manuscript and delivered it and said, here, this is yours. And it was all of his notes. He had basically been working on a sort of parallel project for a long time. And he basically said, this is all yours to use as you wish. I know you're working on a project. Good luck. So it was amazingly generous, and it ended up being a nice collaboration for the three of us. It was wonderful.
Oh, well, he'll obviously be so missed and already is so missed. Jeff, you know, all of you who are really, really dedicated to bird watching are kind of far flung all over the state, but you all know each other. It's a real community, isn't it?
Yeah, it is amazing. And, you know, and nowadays with the internet, even more close-knit, really, and everybody finds out about what everybody else is seeing, you know, almost in literally in real time. And, you know, it's sometimes we forget that's just something that's happened over the last, you know, 10 or 20 years that we've, you know, have that ability. You know, back in the old days, you know, the best you had was, you know, you'd make phone calls around. You know, that's why I would call Peter, you know, is because that was one of the only ways to do it. Or you'd call, there used to be a bird alert at Maine Audubon that somebody would update once a week.
Once a week.
Yeah, and you'd call in, and if it wasn't updated, you know, you'd be so – I remember as a kid, I was so upset when I'd call in, you know, because I'd try to call within hours after when I expected it to be updated, and sometimes they wouldn't have gotten to it, and I'd be so disappointed because my parents would let me make one long-distance call, you know, a week for that, and they weren't right. – it wasn't updated. So, you know, so we've really progressed, and it is a tight-knit community now.
Now it's once a minute.
I know. Well, you know, I think we saw that about a month ago. There were some really rare bird sightings in Maine. And what I loved about, I read about it in the Portland Press Herald, Deirdre Fleming did a great article, is there was a picture of the vermilion flycatcher.
Oh, yes.
But there was also a great picture of a whole bunch of people gathered together. And this is looking for the other incredible rare bird that was spotted.
The field fair.
The field fair. Yeah. And, you know, there are those of you who will maybe not show up at work on a certain day
sick day.
Take a sick day and hop in the car and drive as fast as you can when something's sighted, won't you?
Right. Yeah. The field fair was perfect that way, too. I mean, it sort of exploded on the Maine Birds Google group, and all of a sudden people were rushing up to see it. And it was quite the happening.
And I remember in Evergreen Cemetery, you were almost a rock star, Jan. You and Peter, you know, people were so excited to see you and ask you what else you were seeing and what you were excited about right now.
It's fun to go to these places. You run into a lot of people you know. Yesterday I saw a bunch of folks that hadn't seen for a while. And if you know, you happen to have some expertise and can point things out, you'll draw people and all of a sudden, you're moving along. There might have been two or three of you, and you look back, and there's 10 or 15 of you all of a sudden. It's kind of fun.
Jeff, so why don't I ask you, what are you excited about right now? What have you seen this week that you just can't wait to tell us about?
Well, the migrants are still just pouring in, you know, coming up from South America, Central America, the Caribbean. And so every day there's something new. You know, on the listservs, again, everybody's, you know, putting their first of year, FOY is how what the birder acronym is now for your first of the year sighting of whatever it is, and you know, it's amazing the birds are everywhere. I just had yesterday my first northern water thrush of the year, which isn't particularly early, but it happened to be in a little bit of greenery in downtown Gardner between the Dunkin' Donuts and you know, the A1 Diner along the Cobbessee Stream, very weird little teeny spot of, you know, a few trees, and it had sort of dropped in there for the morning, and as I was getting to work, I could hear it just loudly singing out of that spot. But, yeah, I know the state is just filled with, you know, just about every warbler or sparrow that, you know, you could imagine that normally is coming through is coming through.
Are those warblers and sparrows passing through? Or are they coming for the summer or some of each?
Some of each, yeah. And some of the ones, you know, the numbers right now are particularly high probably because, you know, we estimate there's 1 to 3 billion birds that nest to our north in the boreal region of Canada and Alaska. And they have to get through, you know, the northern border states, including Maine. So, you know, there's literally millions of them that have to pass over our state on their way north, along with all of those that are nesting within our state. So a lot of birds, a huge volume, so lots of opportunities to see really cool things.
And most of them passing through at night as we sleep, and we have no idea what's passing over our heads.
Yes,
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. Jan, what are you excited about this week?
Oh, similar things. One thing that's I've noticed is that, you know, we had a couple of weeks of rather dreary weather, and that sort of slowed things down. We had birds trickling through. But I always like sort of putting my head out in the morning in our own yard. And Monday morning, all of a sudden, you know, the Baltimore Orioles and the catbirds and several other things that sort of just popped into my garden, our resident birds had showed up. So that was really fun. It's kind of fun to hear the audioscape of your own particular house change over time.
Well, I wanted to ask you that because the last couple mornings I have felt as though when I've stepped out of the door the first time in the morning that it's louder and more celebratory. Is it just because I'm perceiving it that way because I'm in a great mood because it's so beautiful outside? Or are the birds celebrating too? I mean, are there more of them and do they sing more lustily when it's a beautiful sunny morning?
Well, I think you as the migrants from the south who are away for the winter are arriving, they are, once they arrive on territory around your house or wherever you are, they are immediately vocal. They are setting up territories and they're advertising and they're looking for mates. And so all of a sudden, you know, you may have heard things during the winter, chickadees and blue jays and nuthatches and things, but now you have this whole array of extra species that have just arrived and they are all very vocal.
And so, but it's not weather dependent. If it were a gray, foggy day, they'd be making noise as well.
Well, that'll be more subdued, right?
I mean, yeah, if it's cold, they won't sing quite as much, and if it's rainy, yeah, they're a little less active. And the migrants, you know, many of the migrants are singing too. And yeah, when it's a nice, you know, sunny, warm day, early in the morning, they all will be singing at the same time, which is, you know, just this wonderful cacophony of sound, you know, symphony of sound that you hear in the morning on a May day.
Is the migration affected by the weather? Is this sort of dreary weather? Or if it rains really hard, will birds not fly? Or do they get up above it and they don't care? No, they don't get above the clouds. So
no, yeah, it does affect them greatly. And that's one of the things that may be changing some of our patterns, you know, in the Northeast, as we've been hearing from meteorologists that, you know, the former pattern of kind of that cloudy weather in spring that used to be hanging over Labrador, northern Quebec and Labrador, is now shifted south to be more over New England in the spring. So we're seeing longer stretches of this kind of weather. That probably does prevent the birds from coming in sort of single waves, you know, and so when it's cloudy and unsettled like that, they sort of seep back in as they can, you know, just when there's openings in the weather. If you have light rain and things like that, they'll still come in. But so much of it depends on kind of the frontal systems to the south. And so the rivers of birds migrating at night just constantly shift. They don't go in the same place all the time. So, you know, they just have to keep changing depending on where the clouds are, where the frontal systems are. And it probably has affected, you know, how we see things.
Mm. Peter, what other changes have you noticed over your years? We know that there are birds here that didn't used to be, most notably the turkey vulture. But what kinds of changes have they been in the years you've been bird watching in Maine?
Well, there have been a number of species that have sort of come into the state from the south that we didn't used to get regularly. Even some of the things that people probably think is common yard birds these days, I mean, cardinals and titmice and even mockingbirds and things like that.
Really? When did cardinals come into Maine?
Well, those are birds that, you know, were really, if you go back into the even early 80s or something like that, they were basically very, you know, a lot rarer.
Hmm.
And some of these things are feeder supported because a lot of more people are feeding birds now, and some of it is probably changes in habitat and also in climate overall. And some birds are able to survive farther north because our winters are milder. And then if you happen to get a real cold winter, for example, you might have a dieback of that particular species. But Carolina wren's another example, red-bellied woodpecker. And then we've had a number of species that used to be confined to York County, basically, if you were birding back in the 80s, a few warblers and things like that now are much more widespread. I mean, prairie warbler and Louisiana water thrush and some other things, even, you know, blue-wing warbler, things like that have really sort of moved up in the state. I think some other changes that have been really noticeable, at least in some areas, are that some of the birds that we used to have a lot more of are just either way down in numbers or absent. And one of the prime examples are some of these aerial insectivores, birds that really catch insects on the wing, not amongst the trees or shrubs, but out in open air flying around. So things like swallows and nighthawks and whippoorwills, those are really, at least in my neighborhood and across most of Maine, I think the numbers are really, really down.
You mentioned bird feeders. Jeff, do you have oranges cut up on your deck right now?
Well, it turns out I just put some out actually today.
I learned that trick from you, but you know what I learned? I don't think they like clementines. I think they have to be oranges.
Interesting. I don't know. I've never put out clementines, but
very picky.
Yeah. I saw my first Orioles of the year actually today, so I quickly put some oranges out.
And yeah. We should say that you cut up oranges and you put them out because you know the Orioles love them.
Yeah, they'll dip into there, and some other birds will too, but Orioles in particular are often.
And you put them on the railing of your deck. Where else could someone put them if they don't have a railing on their deck or a deck?
You can put them into a bush or a tree, you know, sort of stick them onto a twig, or even put a little string on them and hang them. You know, just some way so they'll stay put will work. Yeah.
Okay.
Some people put jelly, little bits of jelly out.
Oh, really? Jan's nodding. Right. You put little bits of jelly out.
I was just going to say that. You know, if the Oriole has cleaned out your orange and you don't want to go get another orange, you can put some grape jelly or something like that.
Okay, so maybe I put my clementines out too early. Maybe they like clementines. The squirrels got them instead. But so we talked very briefly about some of the rare birds that we've seen. I want to talk about another wonderful Dear Fleming article about folks trying to bring back purple martins. Talk about the importance and the sort of the passion behind the purple martins.
Well, that's another one of the aerial insectivores, as Jan mentioned. You know, they're a swallow, really. Martins are sort of large swallows. And they're a bird that nests colonially. They like to nest in cavities, but nowadays in bird boxes that people put up that have many holes in them, those big sort of hotels, you know, purple martin hotels, they call them. And so people have been trying to bring those back, and there's actually a Purple Martin Society that encourages that and sells all kinds of things that you can get, both the houses, the Purple Martin houses, but even things like these tapes you can get that sort of lure in young martins that are looking for a new colony to establish and things like that. And, usually you put them up on a big pole. The Native Americans originally used to apparently hang gourds with holes in them around their villages as a way to sort of attract them and help cut down on insects, on mosquitoes.
We do have to take a break. We're talking with expert bird watchers Jan Pearson and Jeff Wells. What are your questions for them? Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can tweet at Maine Calling, email talk@mainepublic.org, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Anthem Blue Cross and Blue Shield, committed to driving transformation for a healthier future for the people of Maine. Anthem.com. By Seniors Plus, Western Maine's Agency on Aging. Critical services for older adults, disabled adults, and caregivers. SeniorsPlus.org. And CrossFit Beacon in Portland, committed to fostering an inclusive community of all ages and abilities. CrossFitBeacon.com.
So what's the secret to happiness?
If you want to have a happier life, I would say, look at what's unforgiven. Look at where you know you did wrong and you would like to go to that person and say, I'm sorry, can we start over?
I'm Guy Raz. Ideas about forgiveness, why it's important, and why it's so hard, next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Join us for the TED Radio Hour coming up tonight at 11 o'clock. Do you value Maine Public Radio's news and journalism? Would you appreciate classical music and want to help grow our classical network? Would you like to see a strong, robust, and high-impact Maine Public online digital presence? Do you want to serve and strengthen public broadcasting in Maine for the future? Charting a Bold Future is Maine Public's comprehensive campaign to secure the future of public broadcasting in Maine. Support for the campaign is your way to cast your vote for public radio and television in Maine. To learn how you can be a part of Charting a Bold Future, visit mainepublic.org and click on About.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, answers to your questions about birds. In the studio with me, Jeff Wells, a research associate at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, among the many hats he wears in the birding world. And Jan Pearson is the owner and founder of Field Guide Birding Tours. We invite you to join the conversation 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. And I'll start with a Facebook post. This is from Ryan. I'm a fisherman in Lubeck, and we have huge tides. I've been seeing a lot more crane-type birds every year, wading in the shallows at low tide. What are some of the characteristics of these long-legged, dinosaur-looking birds, and how rare are they?
Well, I'm assuming that's a great blue heron.
Sounds like it, yeah.
Yes. We have several species of herons and egrets in Maine, and these are birds that usually wade around in shallow water. They're long-legged, and they have long dagger-like bills, and they are fish eaters. So they're basically hunting to catch fish in the shallows,
spear the fish, right?
They can spear them, but I think they're usually catching them with an open bill.
Oh,
I mean,
okay.
Some other species are actually spearing them more frequently than you would see a heron do. And so when the tide comes in, for example, in that part, it's flooding over the flats and you get a lot of small fish in there. And so you see great blues in there. They might have snowy egrets up there occasionally. They're not really as common that far down the coast. We have a lot more of those here. And a few other species sort of more locally in the Portland or the greater Portland area herons as well.
People often call great blue herons cranes, but there is a different bird called the sandhill crane, which is also increasing in Maine. It's a bit bigger than a great blue heron. And actually, they tend to forage in open fields and wet meadows and in freshwater marshes, not on the coast as much, and they're still fairly uncommon. They're just, kind of spotty here and there. But great blue herons are part of the suite of fish-eating birds that have been increasing in some areas as we've seen increases in some of the fish populations as we've removed dams in places like the Kennebec River, and, fish populations are propping back up in other parts of the state where that's happened. So, in some areas people are seeing more great blue herons and ospreys and eagles, of course, that are so popular for so many people.
Seeing a great blue heron close up, that spear is really impressive, really astonishing.
It is a little frightening,
and they're pretty interesting as far as they'll actually eat other things too. I've got a video of one eating a huge water snake down in Florida. Happened upon it one time, and it just fought with it for probably 15 minutes, before it was able to swallow still living snake.
Someone eat a grackle, an unsuspecting grackle. I walked by it once.
Yeah, they do some crazy stuff.
As a young reporter, I had the opportunity to go into northern New Hampshire. A heron rookery had been destroyed by a storm, and they rescued as many young as they could. And they had it in a bathtub in a house, and they threw some fish. And those fish were gone into the bathtub. Those fish were gone, and I mean, you blink your eye, all of them were gone. It was an astonishing, astonishing thing, and really made you even a little more fearful of what they can do with that spear. We're going to go to Nina, who's calling from Georgetown. Hi, Nina. Go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to say that I've had orioles at my feeder for a couple weeks now. But my first question really was to ask, I've heard a lot of owls this year, and I don't know if they're more than usual, I'm just more aware of it, but I didn't know if they had any tips on how you could maybe see the owls, where to look for them in the daytime, or how you can possibly see them at night.
Hi, Nina.
Hey.
Yes, well, so great horned owls, if you're hearing them at this time of the year, they probably have young, and they're nesting somewhere in your area. Great horned owls start very early and start nesting even in February in some years, so they could have pretty old young, as Jan mentioned, you know, going to see the last year the great horned owl chicks at Evergreen Cemetery in May, and those were probably pretty old. But so trying to find a big pine tree or some place where there's a big stick structure would be, you know, the kind of thing to look. You can actually, in that night, if you're hearing them, great horned owls will often call from the tops of big pine trees or tall structures. So you can actually see them silhouetted if you have a moonlit night, you know, which is kind of cool to see this big, huge bird. Great horned owls are big, you know, with these big ear tufts as they're calling back and forth. Barred owls will sometimes more likely respond to if you do a barred owl imitation, and you can look up what that sounds like on the internet, and you can imitate it yourself. And sometimes they'll actually call back and even come in closer.
Really? So, Jan, you have your iPhone with you. Will you want to let us know what a barred owl and a great horned owl sounds like if anyone is confused by the two?
Let's see if we can pull that up here. Hold on.
Yeah, I've never seen a great horned owl in the wild. I would love to someday. Oh, except for the Evergreen Cemetery chicks. Yeah. Right. But never just sort of stumbled upon one. And
so
I think that'd be so exciting.
Let's see if I have the volume correct. Here's a great horned owl, which is a very deep, low hooting. That gives you an idea of a great horned owl. And a barred owl is the, most people have heard of the sort of classic, the who cooks for you, who cooks for you all.
That's great.
Yeah.
Nina, thanks for your call. We'll go on to Julie, who's calling from Falmouth. Hi, Julie. Go ahead.
Hi. I was calling. I did some research years ago about the North American Migratory Bird Act. I think it was 1906 or something. And there are various laws regarding the migratory birds. I have nesting turkey buzzards on my roof for 5 years, and they said that you could have 2 years in prison or a $5,000 fine or something. So I was just wondering how that would play out. Somebody was talking about putting in a housing development in the neighborhood, and I wasn't sure if that was a legal issue that I could pursue.
Well, let's see. I'm not a legal expert on this, but The laws protecting birds they're pretty strict about most anyone who doesn't have a particular license being able, you know, having to avoid essentially touching, handling birds in any way. So even if you found a dead bird or an injured bird, you're not supposed to pick this up. And the reasons for those laws are basically because they have to have a sort of cut and dried line that nobody can cross, otherwise they have no way of knowing if you picked up a bird dead or you killed the bird and brought it in and wanted to collect its feathers. So it gets complicated very fast. But in terms of something that can be applied if you have some development or potential development going on in your area, that usually only applies to sort of endangered species or species of special concern in some way. And Jeff probably knows
well,
more about this.
Yeah, there are some different laws that could apply, but the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, which is what you were, I think, referring to, and doesn't allow you to take any birds, kill any birds or their nests, any of the migratory birds that are listed in the act, which includes almost all of them, but it's not very effective about destroying their habitat if they're not there. If they're there when you do it, it's against the law. But if they're gone, that it tends to allow that to happen. So there's a lot of intricacies to that, legal intricacies, and lots of work that's actually even been continuing today to test some of that in the courts and in Anyway, it's a bit complicated, but there's a variety of legal things to look into. You could probably call a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service office or your state DEP office or some nonprofits in the area who could give you more specific advice around that.
We'll go to Mary Kate calling from Camden. Hi, Mary Kate. Go ahead.
Hi. Well, I was going to say Tweety, 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 Tweet, and ask what that might be for starters. But I think I found out in the time that I've been waiting on the phone. I pulled out the Eastern Birds Peterson Field Guide off the shelf, and I might have come to that conclusion.
What do you think it is?
Well, are we going to test your people?
Well, it depends how good your imitation is. Jan, what do you think?
Oh, boy.
I'll do it one more time. Ready? Tweety, 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 tweety.
So the challenge here is to know the exact quality.
Yeah.
That's not a rare pattern in bird sounds necessarily.
No, no,
so
no.
If I can't get the quality, it's a little bit difficult.
Why don't you tell us so I can get to some more calls?
Well, I'm thinking a black and white warbler.
That's what I would have thought from the pattern.
Okay.
We just have to make you a lot thinner. A lot thinner sort of on the sound.
Mary Kate, thanks
good.
For your call.
Jennifer, good.
Before I leave you, I just want to thank you so much for Maine calling. It's so great. And I have to tell you, I went outside to read today because it's too beautiful to read inside. And then I thought, oh, no, the bird show's on that Jennifer Rooks is doing. But then I thought, no, they'd be happy that I'm out here in nature. But, okay, so here's my reward. So I'm trying to read this paragraph, but I'm talking back and forth to this bird over the course of a couple pages. And I thought, okay, that's it. Shut the book, got up, went out to try to find him. I learned a technique called pishing from my brother-in-law, who's a great birder, and my sister. I was told I'm a good pisher, which is to try to call them down in the trees. But even before I did that, this warbler, and I think it was a male, just like my call, and he got closer, and it was so great. I've never had a bird come quite that close just from my calling. But then he flew off a little bit, and I'm still talking to him in a distance, and then all of a sudden, into sight come not one, but two hummingbirds, my first hummingbird sighting.
Nice.
And it's just all in my backyard here in Camden. It's delightful. And
well, what a wonderful day. We need to get out of the studio and get out there, too.
Yeah.
Mary Kate, thanks for your call. I really appreciate it. We have a Facebook post from Kristen. For those of you interested in some of the best places to find birds in Maine, I recommend a new book just out, Bird Watching in Maine, A Sight Guide, edited by Derek Lovitch, owner of Freeport Wild Bird Supply. Also a friend of your guys, right?
I think we know that, Kristen.
You know it's Kristen. We have a Facebook post from Susan. I recently had a bird at my feeder that I've never seen since moving to Bowdoin 10 years ago. It had a bright orange body with a black head and wings.
Oh, sounds like an oriole.
Yeah, sounds like an oriole. Very
all
nice.
All right. So we're going to go to Hugh calling from Arundel. Hi, Hugh. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you today?
Great.
All right. I was calling. I was wondering if there's been a statewide decrease in evening grosbeaks. I haven't seen any in quite some time. There certainly is an increase. I have eastern bluebirds at my feeders. I also have that red-bellied woodpeckers, which I hadn't seen prior to about 2 years ago.
I saw one too. I love that. Go ahead.
Yeah, but I haven't seen any of the evening grosbeaks around, especially during the winter.
Okay.
Yeah, there's been a massive decrease in the number of evening grosbeaks from 30 or 40 years ago, when people remember having hundreds sometimes at their backyard feeders, sort of through 50s, 60s, 70s, early 80s maybe even, sort of a, I don't know, 80% decrease, and that's range-wide. There apparently was a big jump in the population that was related to spruce budworm outbreaks at one point. But their range also overlaps with the greatest area that's been cut over across Canada and in the U.S. where their range is. There are still small populations of them that actually are breeding and nesting in Maine in some of the coastal peninsulas. And coastal islands, you'll sometimes run across a few here and there when you're on some of the outer islands and peninsulas. And if you go far north in some of the more boreal forest areas of Maine, there's a few that are around breeding. And people have had, you know, a few here and there in winter, but overall a major decrease over the whole continent.
Yeah, it's one of those things that's quite obvious if you used to drive around, too. You used to see them in sort of, you know, part some times of the year, and you'd see big flocks along the roadside picking up grit from the roadside, and you just don't see that anymore.
Mm. Hugh, thanks for your call. We do have to take another short break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions for Jeff Wells and Jan Pearson. We'll be right back.
You make Maine calling possible, as does Nasson Healthcare, serving York County with medical, dental, and behavioral health services in a state-of-the-art facility. NassonHealthcare.org.
In the course of our lives, we all experience failure, but when it's a space shuttle mission, the consequences can be fatal.
Our job is to keep the crew safe, and they weren't safe, and that's an immediate failure. Now you're just asking, in what way did we fail?
I'm Ari Shapiro. An investigation into the nature of failure, starting this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered with Nora Flaherty from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening. And coming up this afternoon in about 20 minutes in our 2 o'clock Public Affairs Hour, World Affairs welcomes Professor Elliot Cohen from the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, speaking on the use of force in international relations. That's coming up at 2 o'clock in our Public Affairs Hour here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Spring Birding in Maine. In the studio with me, two birding experts, Jan Pearson, owner and founder of Field Guides Birding Tours, and Jeff Wells with the Boreal Songbird Initiative, also with the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and formerly with National Audubon. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. So, oh, boy, we got a lot of questions. Facebook question from Gary. Any birds eat black flies?
Well, I think probably most of the aerial insectivores probably eats black flies, or, you know, some of them. I don't know if probably somebody's done some research somewhere to actually figure out how many, but I don't know offhand. I don't know. Do you know, Jan, any
No,
more
I don't
specifics
either. You know,
about that?
You hear about a lot of birds eating mosquitoes.
Yep.
But
you know, most of these aerial insectivores, you know, they're basically kind of shooting through the air with their mouths open, scooping up insects. You know, that's what they're doing. So you can imagine a big a place where there's very dense black flies with your mouth open shooting through the air, you're probably going to get quite a few of those. So I think they probably do eat a lot of them, but I don't know the specifics of that.
Get a feast. An email from Brian in Rockport. I saw FOI, first of the year, least flycatcher this morning at Beach Hill Preserve in Rockport. And an email from Mango in Bucksport. When is it time to put out the hummingbird feeders?
Now.
Yeah, they've been back for a few weeks, actually.
Yeah, actually. Yeah. And most people don't put them out until they actually see a hummingbird in their yard. But it's actually, you could have put it out 2 weeks ago. And, you know, sometime in this last 2 week period, you would have seen a hummingbird appear. I put mine out late, and I put mine out just a couple of days ago, and as soon as I put it out every year, 5 minutes later, there's a hummingbird at my feeder. So I'm always late on getting it out.
Do you have yours suction cup to the window, or do you have it a little further away?
Well, I did have it suction cup to the window until the suction cup failed, so I built a little jerry-rigged thing to attach it to.
But you do have it right in front of the window.
I do.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to go to Joel, who's calling from Ecology School in Saco. Hi, Joel.
Hi there, how's it going?
Great.
I work at the ecology school. I'm an educator here in Saco. A lot of our curriculum is based around how ecology is all around us, and I find a way to work birds almost into every single one of my lessons. Today we had a group of first graders here, and we were actually learning bird calls and bird sounds. So a lot of opportunities here to get younger students involved in birding, which I'm really excited about. I'm new to Maine. I'm from Pennsylvania, and a lot of my birding has been done in the mid-Atlantic. And I've been focusing a lot of my efforts on York County, and I've found that it's a really special place for birds. And I was just wondering what you all thought would be considered kind of the crown jewel of York County and something that could be shared with students about why York County is such a special place for birds.
Well, York County does have a lot of really great places. One place that's dear to my heart and was dear to Peter Vickery's heart is the Kennebunk Plains. Of course, very special from the perspective of, you know, one of the only sand plain grasslands in the state and one of the largest ones left in all of New England. And so it has a whole host of rare birds and other species like grasshopper sparrows and upland sandpipers and vesper sparrows and other grassland birds, as well as things like black racer snakes and northern blazing star plants, which are this make a beautiful sea of purple in August there. So that's one of the most special places, and I'm sure Jan has some other ideas too.
There's Mount Agamenicus for hawk migration, right? There's
Timber Point.
Go down to the fort at Kittery.
Yeah,
there's a number. And there's a whole the plug that Kristen gave for the new book has a whole bunch of sites in York County in there, too, in the site guide, which is Birdwatching in Maine, right, is the name of the title. And I wonder if Joel knows about, there's a new Young Birders Club in Maine, right, that was just started. Right. Are you aware of that already?
Back about a month ago. Yep.
Yes.
Yeah, I was able to meet them and see them all barrel out of the cars with their scopes and binoculars, and it made me really excited to see that many young kids so stoked on birding.
We need lots of youngsters coming into birding.
Thanks, Joel.
Just to mention the book that I did with my wife, Allison Main's Favorite Birds for Kids, is really a great one that kind of simplifies bird watching down to about 100 of the most commonly seen species, so you can learn them quickly, and a lot of kids find that a helpful way to start off.
Joel, thanks so much for your call. We have a question on Facebook from Heidi. Can you speak to the increase in the population of osprey? I've been noticing pairs and new spots in several areas. That's a tweet.
So since the DDT era, a lot of these birds have really rebounded. During the DDT times, eagles and ospreys and many other birds were harmed by DDT byproducts that caused eggshell thinning, so that basically reproduction was lost. So we lost populations of all of those birds, just plummeted during those times. And so since then, they've been rebounding. And then as we've been cleaning up our rivers, Ed Muskie led the fight for the Clean Water Act and the EPA, all of these things that made our rivers cleaner, brought our fish populations back. As we've taken dams out of places like the Kennebec and the Penobscot, and fish populations are rebounding, it's just, bringing these populations of ospreys and eagles back to probably closer to historic levels. And so we're seeing them expand and do well. And I stepped out of the supermarket last night, and there were, I think, six ospreys flying over me, right in the supermarket parking lot, one with a fish in its talons. And, you're just starting to see sights like that commonly all across the state. It's really nice.
It's hard for younger birders to realize how rare some of these things were. I was out with an ornithology class from Bowdoin with Professor Nat Wheelwright about a month ago, and we saw a bald eagle. And I told them that when I took ornithology to Bowdoin in 1974, we had to drive 45 minutes up the coast to go see the only bald eagle nest anywhere nearby.
Yeah,
that was a big deal, And now I can't leave my house, essentially, on any outing and not see a bald eagle, which is pretty amazing.
An email from Karen. During the Global Bird Day census on May 13th, I was able to count 86 species. Most I saw and heard in Cooper around my home. In a half hour, I saw 14 species of warblers. The males were so pretty in breeding plumage. Is it plumage or plumage?
Plumage.
Plumage. As well as the ruby-throated hummingbirds, Baltimore orioles, rose-breasted grosbeaks, purple finches, etc. I want to add that there is a lesser black-backed gull feeding on herring in the river off Route 191 in East Machias.
Down East Maine has so many species of birds, especially during the birding season. It's no wonder the birding festivals are held here. So we just got a plug in for York County and now for Down East Maine.
Well, and it's probably good at this time, you know, to mention that there are a lot of birding festivals starting. You know, there's one in Down East. There's one in the Blue Hills Downington area. Mount Desert Island has one.
Yeah. Starting, what, June 1 to 4 or something like that, Acadia?
And there's one in Freeport that I think may have happened, and I think L.L. Bean's sponsoring something there later. So there's just more and more of these happening all over, and there's so many, you know, bird clubs and Audubon chapters and land trusts all having bird walks.
We just had a spring birding extravaganza at the Brunswick Topsom Land Trust in our area, and there's all kinds of events to do, and you can go on some field trips and stuff. I know I've got a Matinicus Rock boat trip coming up in early June, and Audubon has the list of things, and other organizations do as well. It's
fun. We're going to go to Barry, who's calling from Camden. Hi, Barry. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hello there. I have an observation that I'm hoping you folks could shed a little light on. I spend the whole of my summer taking folks sailing on multi-day trips out around Penobscot Bay, Blue Hill Bay. And last summer, I saw in extraordinary numbers razor-billed auks in what I would call kind of the upper part of Penobscot Bay. I generally consider those to be pelagic birds. They would be kind of on the outskirts of the bay. But last summer, I saw them up off of Cape Rozier in, by the hundreds in rafts. And I had just looked at that, and I was jumping up and down, and my guests thought I was slipping off the deep end. They couldn't figure out what I was so excited about, and I just hadn't seen anything like that. I assume they're there because there must be something to feed on, and I've had a feeling over the past few years that there are more small fish for pelagics to feed on up in Penobscot Bay.
Okay.
But to see them that far up in the bay where the water's relatively warm, it was a real mystery, and I wondered if you folks could shed some light on that. And perhaps even shed some light on why I'm not seeing so many storm petrels on the outskirts of the bay anymore.
Okay,
so
Barry, thank you. And while you were talking, I looked up the razor-billed auk. It's quite a spectacular bird, white on the bottom, black on top, with some really cool stripes on its bill.
Yeah, that's a seabird, a pelagic bird, as he mentioned, that nests on offshore islands in Maine. So it's on islands with sort of like puffins are. And probably that distribution, I would assume, has to do with where the food is. So if the food's not right around a nesting island and for some one reason or another is farther away, then they may commute farther. Some of these birds go a long distance. He mentioned storm petrels. Leach's storm petrel nests on islands off the coast of Maine. And then we have a second storm petrel in the summer, Wilson storm petrel, that comes up from the South Atlantic. And those things typically aren't seen from shore. But if the wind is right or the feed is right, they will be closer into shore. But some of these birds on one mission to go get food for their young in the nest will go hundreds of miles and come back. So there's a lot of moving around.
And there are a lot of oddities happening in the marine systems, of course, as, you know, with the warming oceans, different fish species. There's sometimes abandonment of colonies of seabirds from further north and birds that just kind of start, you know, prospecting around. So I think that people are seeing lots more oddities. I remember seeing some gannets way up the Kennebec River, far beyond where I normally would see them a couple of years ago. And, you know, just you don't really know what's going on, but you do wonder if, you know, because of this changing seas and where fish are located. And so it's something going on that we don't fully understand, but yeah.
We have a Facebook post from Marianne. We have an indigo bunting. Oh, excuse me. We have indigo buntings and scarlet tanagers this past weekend, and one sighting of an orange, true orange bird, no black on head and a black stripe on the wing, mostly orange on the entire body, grosbeak size, not an oriole. Help.
Well, there are variants in scarlet tanagers, occasionally where they do look orange, or they actually are a bit orange from some sort of a genetic factor or something that they've eaten or whatever. And that sounds like if it's an all-black wing, it sounds almost like a a male scarlet tanager whose scarlet is messed up so he looks orange, but that's one possibility.
I'd go with that.
Okay. We'll go to Robin from Kennebunk. Hi, Robin. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling. Robin, are you there? Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, we can hear you now. Go ahead.
Okay. A bird I love to hate, the English sparrow, quote unquote, evil bird, kills my bluebird, swallows, hogs up all the nests. Any suggestions on what to do with the evil species that we were given?
Wow.
And we're almost at the end of the hour,
yeah, that's too. That's right. Well, not sure what to do about house sparrows, English sparrows. They are problematic for sure. If you have multiple boxes up, sometimes that, you know, might help in terms of one species keeping the same species out of an adjacent box, but I'm not sure if that's going to work with house sparrows so well.
They actually, believe it or not, overall are apparently declining, if that's
any
consolation
solace.
Solace. But they are not covered by the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, just so you know, which means that it is technically not illegal to harm them. Not that I'm necessarily condoning that, but you know, that some people do take measures into their own hands that way. So, but yeah, they were a bird that was introduced back in, I think, the early 1900s. I'm not sure I remember the exact date, or late 1800s, by a group supposedly that was trying to introduce all the birds that were mentioned in Shakespeare to North America for some strange reason. And they went through a couple of species, starlings and English sparrows or house sparrows, before they stopped. But after just those two introductions caused those species to spread over the entire North American continent and actually down into some of them into Central and parts of South America. So
it's been trouble ever since.
Robin, thank you for your call. I'm going to try to squeeze in one more question. This is an email from Nancy. The bird song from my woods and yard is amazing and beautiful from 4 a.m. onward. How can I, as a novice, begin to identify the different birds singing?
Ooh. Well, there's quite a few resources. There's a great site run by Cornell called All About Birds, and you can go look up different species there and listen to their sounds as well as learn their identification, you know, their field marks and their behavior. There are lots of apps for your smartphone if you want to get them. There's one called Bird Tunes. There's a Warbler Guide. There's a whole bunch of them. And there's also a great online resource called Xenocanto. It's xenocanto.org. And that has bird sounds from all over the world. So no matter what you want to look up, you can
probably find it. Okay, so we're going to post some of that on our Facebook page. I have to say thank you. The hour goes so quickly. You just heard Jan Pearson, the owner and founder of Field Guides Bird Tours. And Jeff Wells is here, too. Jeff works at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. He has worked at National Audubon, and he is the founder and one of the principals at the Boreal Songbird Initiative. John Keimel ran the board today. Dan Plummer answered your calls. We had additional help from Lily McKenzie. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.